from the Sky News Centre at 5. A huge blow's been dealt to the local economy on Teesside, where a giant steel plant is being mothballed. 1,700 jobs are being lost at the Corus site in Redcar. Local MP Vera Baird says it's a gut-wrenching disappointment. Bob Stainthorpe of the Unite Union says the plant is a major employer in the region.
There's 150 years history of steel making in this area. This area was built on steel, and it's been taken away in 5 minutes this morning at 9 o'clock. Absolute shock.
Two 19-year-old rappers who tried to drown a pregnant girl in a London canal have been jailed. One of them thought if she had the child, it would damage his chances of becoming famous. Kingsley Ogundele and Brandon Jolie have been given 18 and 14-year sentences, respectively, at the Old Bailey. It's thought a man shot dead during an apparent robbery outside a money transfer shop was carrying a big bag of cash. Kurram Ashraf was blasted once in the stomach in South Manchester after he and a colleague were ambushed by a lone gunman demanding he hand over the takings. A 20-year-old man has been arrested. The draw for the World Cup finals is getting underway at a ceremony in Cape Town. The draw will decide who plays who in the group stage. England are among the top seeds, meaning they'll avoid most of the favourites like Brazil and Spain. David Beckham says they're feeling confident.
When you come into a World Cup, I think you can't fear anybody, and I think you have to, whoever you get, you have to believe that you can beat them, and we'll do that.
England's cricketers have won the one-day series against South Africa with a bit of help from the weather. The final match in Durban has been rained off without a ball being bowled. It means England win the series 2-1. The UK's official UFO investigation unit has been closed. The MOD's confirmed a hotline and email address isn't staffed anymore. The unit was created for the public to report strange sightings over 50 years ago. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Call 0800 612 0225 or visit our website on www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free.
Welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Joining us here in the studio to discuss some of the big stories this week in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Liberal Democrat councillor for Lawrence Hill and chair of Community Cohesion and Safety, the Scrutiny Committee, that is. That's Sue O'Donnell. Our regular Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour from six, Sue will shuffle out and Billy Quain will shuffle in with his guide to what's on for free over the weekend. And we'll be hearing why human rights lawyers across the country are condemning control orders and ASBOs as an affront to justice. Also, after six, we delve into the history of the Russian Revolution, finding out all about the mad monk who's supposed to have been behind it all. Or was he? Marina Morris uncovers some of the facts behind the legend that is Rasputin. We'll be discussing this week's news in a moment, but first, here's our two-week Friday Drive Time weather forecast from metcheck.com. Temperatures this weekend averaging around about 4 degrees Celsius, and it can be cloudy and wet all weekend, except a little bit of tiny little interval on Sunday afternoon. Next week, averaging 5 degrees, a little tiny bit warmer, still cold though. It'll be rainy at the beginning of the week and it should be clearing up by Wednesday through to the end of next week. Next weekend, that's the 12th and 13th of December, warmer, averaging around about 10 degrees Celsius, dry on Saturday, rain on Sunday, but getting much windier over the weekend and very windy on Sunday. That was a long-range weather forecast for the next fortnight from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and with us in the studio this week is Councillor for Lawrence Hill and Chair of the Community Cohesion and Safety Scrutiny Committee, Sue O'Donnell. Hi, welcome to Drive Time, Sue.
Thank you very much for asking me.
And first of all, how long have you actually been a councillor here in Bristol?
I was elected in 2004. at a by-election.
Okay, and what did you do before that? What experience do you bring to the council?
Well, before that, I was an HR advisor for an insurance company. In fact, I was working as an HR advisor for an insurance company up until 2008.
So that's personnel in old-fashioned terms,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, dealing with the problem cases and also the good stuff as well, like the promotions and helping people move their career.
Okay, and are you from Bristol?
Yes, born and bred.
Whereabouts?
Actually, I still live in the house that I was taken from the hospital to.
Oh, right.
In Easton, so...
In Easton. And what do you do? This is quite a long-winded-sounding committee, this Community Cohesion and Safety Scrutiny Committee. What do you actually do as chair of that?
Well, it's quite interesting. I can give you one classical example at the moment is we held an inquiry day last week, specifically looking at human trafficking and the council and the council's partners' responsibilities under the changes in legislation. So we had a guest speaker come over from the Dublin Migrant Rights Centre. We had a professor from UWE come along to talk about some of the problems that they'd uncovered when they've been researching it. We actually got one of her PhD students who'd actually been interviewing people who had been the victims of human trafficking to come along and put some actual personal stories behind some of the statistics and figures that we keep getting bandied about.
So you're part, does that mean you're part of the cabinet or you're just sort of on the fringes?
Oh,
you're not quite there yet?
Not part of the cabinet. I just chair a scrutiny commission and I'm happy to do that.
But you see, that's interesting, isn't it? You're doing the scrutinising, but actually, you're a Liberal Democrat yourself, but the Liberal Democrats are in power. You would have thought that it would be the opposing parties that would actually be doing the scrutinising of what goes on at the council.
Well, with this particular commission, our role is to scrutinise the work of the Safer Bristol Partnership and the police in relation to their responsibilities and the fiduciary responsibilities to the council.
That's money, is it?
Yeah, cash. Yeah. Cold, hard cash. Basically, it's looking at making sure that Safer Bristol and the police authority, when looking at the bits that are involved with the council, provide value for money and make sense, really.
And do they? Because, I mean, actually, it's Avon and Somerset Police, isn't it? So you must be funded, I guess, or they must be funded partly by Somerset Council and partly by Bristol City Council. Is that right?
That's a very good question, actually. I've never really thought about who provides the total funding. I know one thing that I've been researching recently is the extra money that the council have put in for PCSOs, because, obviously, we recognise the value of having more people on the streets, and if the government aren't going to provide money to get more police officers, the least we can do is get more uniforms on by helping them out that way.
But isn't this doing it on the cheap with these PCSOs? I've heard them referred to as, well, sort of half-hearted, half-baked police officers. So is it really any point in spending this money on the PCSOs when they're only... I think chimps, I heard them referred to, cannot help in most police situations.
That's it. I think that's really cruel. I'm working with some of the PCSOs I've been working with, specifically in my particular beat, they're extremely helpful. In fact, they tend to be the people that are actually in on the ground having the conversations with people. They become part of the community, and for me, and the most important thing is the community has somebody that they can see on a regular basis, they can trust, and they can talk to.
Well, this is because all the PCs are either in their cars or stashed away in a police station somewhere, isn't it?
I think there are issues with regard to the amount of paperwork and bureaucracy that has been brought in, and I am a little concerned that the focus seems to have moved from policing to target setting and target meeting. But, I mean, I've got to be honest... My beat manager, the beat manager for the house in which I live, a beat officer, he's really, really good. He's extremely community focused. So there is a real strong element of community policing out there. I mean, we've got to remember that your community beat officers, the officer that you'll see regularly, the fast response teams don't tend to interact to the same level with communities.
Well, there's another thing there, because about 3 or 4 weeks ago on here, we were talking about some report that had been done by the Inspector of Constabularies, and they were finding that the Bristol Police have a very long response time to 999 calls. In fact, there were several instances where they weren't responding, but maybe we can talk about that a bit more later on. Now, Martin Summers is joining us as well, our old Labour economics expert and sometime pundit, and also it's his 50th birthday today, so
happy birthday, Martin.
Martin, you used to work in be a teacher in a free school. Can you tell us when that was and how it was different to an ordinary school?
Well, that's when I left university in 1980. I went to work for Kirkdale Free School in South London, which was set up in 1964 originally by a radical teacher called Susie Powsland, who was actually a woodcraft folk organiser, and she used to take woodcraft folk camping trips in the summer, and she just decided, well, why don't we have a school like this in the in term time? So that was it was set up in 1964. I didn't go to work there till 1980.
So how was it different then to the sort of what we'd normally expect at a school?
There's no big mystery about it, really. We just had very small classes. I mean, basically, we were paid very, very badly. You know, we were paid literally, you know, peanuts. But we were all happy to work there because it was an opportunity to actually work with children in a very creative way, because there were 8 children in my class, so I could give them all individual attention. We didn't have to have lots of silly rules and regulations, not necessary in a small group like that. There were maybe 30 children in the whole school.
Didn't the children, to a certain extent themselves, choose the curriculum that they were learning?
The whole philosophy was that they would do, you know, pretty much what they wanted. But, of course, what they want to do is actually learn things. If this is things going on, then they want to get involved in it. And, you know, we had our fair share of kids who'd been kicked out of other places and didn't have, because their behaviour was not manageable. And we were able to integrate them much more successfully. There was a wide cross-section of children in the school. Some were, as it were, rejects from the system, and others had been put there because their parents were very keen for them to have that kind of experience. And we did in fact set up the possibility of being fully funded by the local education authority. We actually had various funding streams, but unfortunately it all came to nothing with the Conservatives came to power and abolished the Inner London Education Authority and pushed the whole school system in a completely different direction.
But so it wasn't like the Lord of the Flies then, and the kids weren't running wild?
Well, no, because if you've got adults interacting closely with them all day, I mean, you know, you can pick up any bad behaviour almost immediately. And of course there was a lot of nagging involved, but the rules were set by school meetings. So we'd have a meeting once a week where the rules would be decided through discussion, and sometimes that was a little bit artificial. You know, we had 3-year-olds sitting there, sort of sucking on their fingers, watching all of these disputes. And then one 3-year-old would put their hand up and say, I think we should do so-and-so. And that's exactly what we were trying to inculcate in the children. This is a democracy. You can speak here. We want to hear what you've got to say.
I wonder how that would run at Brislington School. Anyway, let's take a look at some...
They haven't got the key to anything like that is having people power. Yes, you've got enough people to deal with the situation. Many schools have got classes much bigger than that. And, of course, you can't have a free and easy situation if you've got a class of 30. It's just not feasible.
Okay, let's have a look at some of this week's news stories. We're starting off with a local one this week. Drug-dealing Bristol mother did it for her children, apparently. A mum, this is in the Evening Post earlier this week, I think yesterday, said she dealt drugs to support her 2 children and sick father. She's been jailed for 2.5 years. Kelly Smith of Kensington Park Eastern smiled at police officers when she was caught red-handed at her home, Bristol Crown Court has heard yesterday. When they asked her why, the court was told that she replied, "Because I know what you are going to find." Prosecuting Paul Ricketts said the officers found 63 wraps of cocaine, 55 purple wraps of heroin, weighing a total of 43 grams, which she planned to sell for £10 a wrap. Is it a reasonable excuse, Sue, do you think, for someone to say, I'm just doing it for my children?
Well, this particular case is interesting because I understand that she was actually then discovered with more drugs in the property after she'd already been arrested once. I have to be honest, I don't think it is a reasonable excuse to say that I'm doing it for my children. There are thousands of families out there, all single parents as well, who are coping and actually going out to work or finding other ways to earn the money to do it legally. And the fact that she's selling drugs, she's giving those drugs to somebody else's children. Effectively, she's making those drugs available to other people's children. So, you know, that's a... I know it's a slightly more difficult argument to prove, but, you know, you've got to have some moral basis, because those kids will grow up knowing that their mother was a drug dealer. And what examples does that give them for things to aspire to?
But don't you think that there are all sorts of pressures pushing people into this road, you know, down this road, that they would not choose to go down, but when they're struggling with, particularly single parents or whatever, struggling to bring up children, they find that actually there's an easy way to make illegal money locally. Don't you have any sympathy for them when they just say, well, let's just do drug dealing instead?
Don't get me wrong, I have sympathy for anybody bringing up children in this day and age, because it is a very, very difficult time to bring up children. But I think maybe you need to look at the pros and cons, because once you're caught, you're sent to prison for 2 years. Those children are now taken off their mother. They may end up in the care system, and when she's released, she may not get them back. So long-term argument is that the best thing for those children? I'd like to think that a parent would think about the consequences before taking any course of action like this.
Martin?
Well, I mean, I would just take a slightly different tack on this. We've had a war on drugs now for 30, 40 years. It's not succeeding. Drugs are clearly available and still available. In Latin America, former President Cardoso has just put together a report with lots of senior Latin American politicians saying we've got to look at legalising the drugs trade because it's actually corrupting all of our institutions. The dirty money is not taxed, nobody knows where it goes, and it goes into buying political
bots. But isn't that just giving in to the big international drug dealers?
You can't beat the market. Somebody else will be taking the market that this lady was operating. And I'm not suggesting that we should just say we could go into Sainsbury's and buy drugs. I'm not suggesting that. Things like heroin, for example, we used to have a system in Britain until 1968. If people were heroin addicts, they would go to the doctor would register them as heroin addicts, and then give them heroin so that they don't have to go out and steal, deal, or do anything. And if they want to come off, they come off. But you put them on a maintaining dose, and you try and destroy the illegal market. When alcohol was made illegal in the United States during the 1920s, organised crime got a grip on US politics, which is not let go of to this day. And that is what is happening all over the world. Nobody says that taking drugs is good for you. Anybody listening to this should realise that there's all sorts of dangers involved. But the illegality of it makes everything worse. And we're not succeeding. You can't succeed. Because whenever the price of drugs continuously goes down, because the profit margins are so high that somebody else will come in and take over that gap. And I think we've just got to start talking rationally about this. I know it's difficult. It's very emotive. And everybody's got lots of shocking stories to say about the damage that drugs can do. But if we don't take a step back and look at this properly, we're going to be overwhelmed by organised crime.
That's actually a really interesting angle to take on this. And I think the one question I would ask, and it's a question that I've thought about myself, is do you think any government will be brave enough to take that step?
Well, at the moment, no. And one of the problems is that when countries like the Netherlands, for example, at international conferences, their police officers say, well, why don't we try a more, you know, softly approach? They are shouted down by the United States people who just say no, we've got to crush all of this. And what's paradoxical about this, of course, is that the United States' allies in developing countries, like in Afghanistan and Colombia, are the major drug dealers. Walid Karzai, who is the brother of Hamid Karzai, who is the president of Afghanistan, is on the record as being on the CIA payroll. He's also recognised by the Drug Enforcement Administration as the major drugs kingpin in Afghanistan. And one of the reasons why the United States blocks any kind of discussion of legalisation is because the CIA have used illegal drugs markets for years to fund their allies. They started in China in the 1940s by allowing the nationalists to ship heroin to the United States so they could fight the communists. They carried on in Vietnam, where they allowed the Hmong minority to produce heroin because they were allied with them against the Vietnamese communists. And in Colombia, the right-wing paramilitaries and death squads are all drug dealers in alliance with the army, which is in alliance with the United States. So it's actually been a key part of US foreign policy to promote hard drugs. This is all factual stuff, but we don't hear a lot of it in the mainstream media, do we?
No. you hear quite a lot of it on this show, though, because we do discuss it probably once a month, the whole sort of illegal trade in drugs. Anyway, on to the next story. Portishead shop worker is more popular than Johnny Depp. Well, he really was more popular than Johnny Depp. This is an incredible thing. It's a Facebook campaign down in Portishead led to this shop worker, Nigel Parker, being the person who switched on the lights. And we're just discussing this in a little minute, but in the meantime, let's just have a little listen to Nigel.
It's very cold this morning, unfortunately. It's really very, very cold this morning.
It's lovely to see a shop assistant that smiles, helpful, and, you know, really pleased to see you and serve you.
I mean, the queue's 30 miles long because he's talking all the time.
I wish everybody was like that in the shops, to be honest with you.
Myself as a person, I've never seemed to be miserable, not even work. No, I come each day, it's excitement, because I suppose every day's different, really, I suppose.
to see a local person that everyone knows switch on the lights. None of this celebrity business. No, we want Nigel.
Well done, Nigel. Thank you. Congratulations. Thank you very much. Nigel,
they're shouting. Look, they've even got I Love Nigel t-shirts. This man has become a local hero, and this is his moment. Nigel.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yes, Portishead's Head's Finest there, that story from the beginning of the week. Sue, what are your thoughts about this? Do you think this is something we could see more of in the future? Very much sort of ordinary people taking the place of celebrities?
Oh, yes, I really hope so. I think this is a fantastic story. I happened to catch it during the week. And Nigel was interviewed, as you could hear there. He came across as such a nice, pleasant, helpful chap who was completely overawed, really, by all of this interest in him. And I thought that is really significant, that people recognise this guy as a really nice guy who helps them out, who does his job well, and they think that that's important. So hopefully that does sort of have a wind, winds of change coming.
Well, it's interesting. I think the Portishead Town Council, or whoever they are, have scored a major PR victory, because this story's been covered all over the world. And I imagine if it was Johnny Depp that had switched on the Portishead lights, that would probably just about have made it onto Points West. Martin, what are your thoughts about the choice to switch on the Christmas lights in Portishead?
Nigel doesn't become a celebrity now. because this is how celebrities are made, isn't it? You know, they go on reality TV shows, and they were nobody before they went on, and afterwards they become multi-millionaires. I hope he's not spoilt by the fame and that the money doesn't corrupt him.
Okay, next story, climate. This is getting a bit more serious again here. The climate research head has stepped down from East Anglia University after an email leak. Now, this has been a massive story for really the last week or so, and it's been called Climate Gate. Phil Jones, director of the University of East Anglia's climate research unit, has announced he will stand down while an independent review investigates allegations of professional misconduct, according to a UEA University of East Anglia press release. The leaked emails about climate change, which have been being used in research at the university, have triggered a maelstrom of allegations that Jones and his colleagues manipulated data, denied critics access to data, and blocked the research they disagreed with from being included in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Fourth Assessment Report. Now, the most worrying thing for me for regards this story is it's important for us as journalists always to have access to the raw data, so you see a press release or you see the basic report, but you're also able to then go back and check how was that report put together. And it seems that there's been none of this going on in East Anglia. Martin, do you want to start on this one?
Well, I mean, this is very, very unfortunate to come out just before the climate conference in Copenhagen.
Well, could it be deliberate? Is this a manoeuvre by the oil industry?
A leak from inside the East Anglia University.
But is it the oil industry, do you think, here, that may be actually behind this? Maybe
well,
have got this information
I,
and
I
pushing it out?
I mean, the timing clearly is political. It's an attempt by whoever has leaked it to sabotage the climate talks. But nevertheless, there is a case to answer here. I mean, people who are, you know, scientists who are believers in climate change and want action to be taken are very angry about the fact that these people have been fiddling the figures, because it discredits the whole discussion.
Well, they've let the side down.
They have very much let the side down. What I would say about climate change, I think it's a very emotive subject, and it's very difficult for lay people to have a strong opinion. We've been told for several years now that the scientific consensus was that it was happening. That seems to be in doubt now, which leaves ordinary people in a bit of a quandary. But what I would say about all of this is that we've got to stop using up the Earth's resources as if there was no tomorrow, whatever is happening with the climate. Yeah? We've got a situation where we're basically just consuming everything, and we're just going through everything like a dose of salt, and when it's gone, it's gone. And if we don't stop doing this, we're going to come to grief one way or another, and it's not just climate that we've got to worry about.
Yeah, I've got to agree with that point. I think, as you rightly say, when it's gone, it's gone. I think for me the big worrying factor is, I'm a lay person. I don't really know the facts on either side of the argument, so I rely on people to give me accurate information so that I can make a decision. And this calls into question the validity of a lot of the information that we've read and talked about over the past few years. But concerningly, it could call into question the validity of the argument. And I think that is too significant a fact to overlook, because irrespective of why you, whether you feel that you know, climate change is happening or is not happening, as much as we do need to stop going through all the resources that we've got on this planet, because you know, we're going to burn the planet up ourselves. We're going to be responsible for this. We've got to start looking at more ecologically friendly ways, more, you know, increase our recycling and reusability, and look at more environmentally friendly fuels to use. So, you know, if we use wind power, if we use sea power, I'm not an expert, but I'm looking to the experts to tell me what we can use that isn't going to hurt the planet.
One of the most important things we've got to do is just be more efficient with the energy we use. We waste so much. All of our kit loses. I mean, that's actually very doable. The technology to make things efficient exists, but the market won't do it on its own. There's got to be a lead from government to say this is the standard we want. In Germany, for example, when they're building new houses, they've got to be 100% energy efficient. We don't have that in this country. But I mean, that's the way to deal with problems, is to not use the stuff up in the first place.
Well, I think you'll find the building regulations actually been over the last few years really tightened up, and when they're built, new houses are being built, there's actually quite a lot of regulations.
In Germany, they do everything Vorsprungbergtechnik, technique. It's 100% energy efficiency, and that's what they expect.
Yeah. Isn't there an interesting side to this that we're, you know, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? If we are actually going to rein back our use of resources, surely we're going to be reining back our economy too.
Not necessarily.
That's going to help the recession kick in.
What you have to do is redistribute. It's also about social justice. A small proportion of the world's population is basically using most of these resources up, and there's got to be fairer sharing of the use of those resources. And that means that there's plenty of things there's plenty of room to expand the economy, educating people, putting them to work in high value occupations instead of low value occupations. We need to improve and modernise the economy all over the world. So there's plenty of scope for expansion. But we've got to do it in a way that doesn't destroy the environment.
So, Sue, if I told you you have to come down on one side or other of the climate change debate, now I'm not saying that climate change is not happening, but to what extent do you think, in your heart of hearts, that it's something which is a human-made thing, and to what extent is it part of maybe the Earth's natural cycle?
Oh, you don't want percentages, do you? No, I have to.
If you had to come down on one side or the other, where do you lean?
Whilst I recognise it's part of the Earth's natural cycle, I think there is enough evidence out there to say that since the industrialisation started, that the cycle has significantly speeded up. And what worries me is that there's no indicators to say that it will slow down or cease. So I do think man has to take quite a lot of responsibility for where we stand today.
Definitely. One of the most interesting arguments I've come across, though, over climate change is this report from the Hudson Institute, which is sort of connected with this American US military think tank called the RAND Corporation, which back in 1968 brought out a report called The Report from Iron Mountain, and it came up with the idea of climate chaos and aliens as two possible things that could replace the Russians as the big threat once the Russians went away. But the Hudson Institute's an interesting little organisation. This is from the 1960s, and those books are still, you know, you can still get the report from Iron Mountain now, and it's old sort of old-fashioned 1968. And I think that's one of the more interesting aspects to the climate change debate.
Can I just come in on this? One of the things they're going to be discussing at Copenhagen is this whole idea of cap and trade, creating a kind of market in carbon pollution permissions.
Yeah.
And Wall Street are pushing very strongly for this because they see this as a potential bubble for them. Another bubble, as if we needed another bubble. But I'm glad to see that Friends of the Earth's submission to Copenhagen says we're not interested in this market solution of trading carbon permits. If we want to reduce carbon emissions, we need to set ourselves a target, and we need to plan to hit that target. Yeah, I mean, I'm a socialist. I believe in economic planning, and the economic planning is coming back big style. The market can't be allowed to do all of this, and the market won't do it. And they're trying to invent markets in carbon trading in order to keep the market solution on the boil. But we don't need another hedge fund bubble. What we need is actually reductions in carbon footprint.
Okay, so what about Copenhagen then? Are you going to be watching that avidly, and what are you hoping to see come out of it? If you are going to be watching it avidly.
Am I going to be watching it avidly? I probably won't have time to watch it avidly, but I will, I think, be very interested to see what comes out of it. And I will, more importantly for me, I'll be interested to see what measurable, what smart measures come out of it so that we all should have an idea of what we're trying to do. Even more interesting, I'd like to see the government responses to what comes out of Copenhagen, because we work in with a government that sets itself targets that when it doesn't reach them, just ignores the fact that it hasn't reached them and sets itself bigger targets. And I'm just a little bit wary about, governments that set targets and then ignore the fact that they've set a target and do nothing to try and achieve it.
Now, we've tried something a little bit new this week with you, so I hope you don't mind us experimenting. I asked you to bring in a record.
I did.
In fact, it's not a record, it's a CD, to be honest with you, of your own choice. And we will play that now. Would you like to just introduce it for us?
Well, this is a track that I've only come across, really, in the past week or so, but it had a profound effect on me. Everybody will snigger when I say it's Susan Boyle. But the track's called Proud, and it's on the CD that's just come out, but it made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up when I heard it. It was that good.
All of my life I have watched you climbing mountains, chasing dreams. All of my life you gave me everything. You don't have to give the world to me. Just say you love me as I say you want me as I am. Say I'm someone in your eyes. That's all I wanted to be. Oh, just let me go. One day I'll make you proud. All of your life you've taken chances, broke the rules time after time. All of your life you proud. Though you can't see it now, someday I'll make you proud.
There's Susan Boyle there from her album CD I Dreamed a Dream, and that song was Proud, the choice of Sue O'Donnell. So we're going to move on to our next story now, and this is to do with cycling. Heard really two stories this week. It's to do with lorries and the road. This week, the police put truck. This is a gigantic truck, which apparently a lorry, I should say, really, that weighs over 60 tons when fully loaded. Even though the maximum that's allowed on British roads is 44 tons, and this lorry, even though it was illegal to use on British roads, was rolled out in Scotland, I believe, by a haulage guy, guy that owned a haulage firm, Dick Denby, and he actually got stopped immediately by the police. At the same time, we also see another injury on White Ladies Road with a lorry actually running over a cyclist. I'm really not sure how this person is getting on, but that was just the day before yesterday. I got this on Bristol247.com, one of Bristol's new news websites. And I wonder what your thoughts are on the safety of having these lorries going through our city centres, and the haulage industry even trying to put bigger lorries on our roads.
Well, I'm not a driver, firstly. I'm a pedestrian and I use public transport, and I would like to be a cyclist, but I'll be honest, I would be nervous to cycle on some of the main roads around the city. I must say it's getting better with the introduction of more cycle lanes and the fact that more publicity is coming out about cyclists. But I hope this lady's okay. With regard to traffic, it's an interesting argument because there's the integration of industry and heavy traffic, motorists, cyclists and pedestrians. And I think any sensible and successful traffic management plan has to recognise that each of those groups has to be successfully integrated. So, you know, you need to look at how you can operate lorries on our roads, just as much as you need to look at how many pedestrian crossings you need to put in so people can get from one side of the road to the other.
It does seem to me that the idea of cyclists cycling along a sort of a busy road along with these enormous lorries, the two just don't go together. They don't mix, do they? I mean, for example, the lorry drivers can't even, half the time, may not even be able to see the cyclist. You know?
I mean, this is not something I'm an expert in, but I would be interested to see how this works in Europe, because obviously we as a nation don't seem to be forgive me for stating what may be the obvious to some pro cyclists. There seems to be a very heavy car lobby, you know, and I have no objection to people liking driving their cars and liking being on the road, but the key thing to remember is that you're not the only person on the road. You are not the sole road user. You have to be aware of what other road users are doing at any stage, and most drivers that are relatively responsible, especially when they know that they're close to a school or where children are likely to be, because of campaigns that have been run in the past, you know, on television, the adverts showing what happens to a child if they're hit by a car.
But at the end of the day, this doesn't really affect the hauliers. If they've got to get their lorry into some through some suburban streets into a place, I mean, they're bound to come across, you know, children and cyclists. Martin, do you want to talk about that?
This is a very interesting case where the police have banned this big lorry, because of course the main damage to our roads is done by heavy lorries. Cars, in fact, do very minimal damage to roads. If there were no lorries on the road, there'd be no need to keep fixing the roads. But the road haulage lobby does not pay a vehicle tax, which is consistent with the actual amount of damage that they do. Now, if
what you're saying is that the car drivers, when they pay their car tax,
are subsidising the lorries. That's right. And we've allowed ourselves to allow this situation to develop. You know, we've allowed our branch lines for the railways to fade away. We've not had any kind of overall thought or plan for what we want to do. We've just let the market decide. But of course, the market is rigged, and the market is rigged in favour of heavy lorries. This is silliness. Go on the polluter pays principle, charged lorries exactly the damage for the damage they actually do, then it wouldn't be economically viable to use lorries for a lot of things, and alternatives would have to be found.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And the other thing that I would say is maybe we and road hauliers need to start looking at the reasons why some of these big lorries have to come into towns and cities. I suppose the argument is that the damage would still be done to motorways, but You know, there have been lots of scheme entry where people delivering stock to shops deliver to an external point and a much smaller truck a much more friendly version of the truck is used to actually get it into the stores that need to sell it. So, you know, there is an element here about they have to take some responsibility about thinking about the impact that they have on the communities that they're driving through and working.
I mean, are they going to do this voluntarily or need their arm twisting?
They're going to need their arm twisted, aren't they? And the other thing that what's happened with supermarkets now is that they have this just-in-time supplies. So actually, everything going for the supermarkets for Monday will leave on Sunday and will be actually not. They don't have to keep it in a warehouse. They actually warehouse it in the trucks as it's being moved around. Now we've allowed this to develop over the years because the road haulage lobby and the road building industry have basically captured the state. And what we need in politics is more transparency about how money is actually spent, because if people knew how money was actually spent, they might decide to spend it differently. But there's a veil drawn over this, and people tell, oh, well, you don't really understand, you don't need to understand this, we're going to, you know, the plan is the plan. And we've had a Labour government now for how many years it is, and they said they were going to have an integrated transport strategy. Do you remember John Prescott was going to be the transport supremo and all the rest of it? What's happened to all of that? Nothing. We've just got more cars, more lorries, same old, same old.
Well, one of the other things that I've noticed is this is about, I think, 5 years ago, roughly, maybe 6 years ago, that the European Union introduced the heavier axle weights for lorries on British roads. Now, this is a really crazy thing to do, because this is something that came through the EU, because our roads are all designed to take a certain amount of axle weights. Mm. And what's happening, if you go up to the hill at Brislington, the A4 there, you can see the road has just been totally crumpled by these heavy lorries stopping and starting on the way up the hill. And our motorways have become rutted by these heavy axle weight lorries. Now, this is just simply the power of the road lobby that's enabled this to happen. That bigger and bigger lorries. This is not. Let's not blame the lorry drivers for this. It's the industry, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah,
okay, that's me off my soapbox. Next story, we're on to Europe again, I think. Oh, no, hang on. No, this is to do with the Crown Prosecution Service. We hear at the beginning of the week that hundreds of criminal cases have been thrown out of court due to Crown Prosecution Service delays. Now, as someone that deals with the police as part of what you do, Sue, maybe you could just explain to us what the Crown Prosecution Service is, because, you know, we hear about it, but do we actually know what it does?
Well, just to reiterate, I don't actually scrutinise the police or the CPS. I scrutinise their involvement with Safer Bristol, which we fund. But the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, basically, the buck stops with them when deciding whether a case is going to go to court or not. It's not the PC that makes the arrest or the people in the police station. It's the Crown Prosecution Service who will look at the evidence that's produced and decide whether it is in the public interest to prosecute a case.
Okay.
That's my understanding of what they do anyway.
Okay, and they're relatively recent again, aren't they? Sort of came in, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. And I think before that, it was actually the police that decided, wasn't it? Whether a case was going to go to court, and then there was committal proceedings at the beginning, and then it would go to a full trial. Anyhow, Crown Prosecution Service have got massive delays going on, apparently, and quite important investigations. This is a Daily Mail on Sunday, last weekend's Mail on Sunday, up to 4,000 subjects have failed to appear before magistrates because the Crown Prosecution Service did not get their files ready in time, according to the figures obtained by the Freedom of Information Act. It's another one of these wonderful Freedom of Information requests where you find just how horrendous these quangos or whatever the CPS is are. So what are your thoughts anyway, Sue, on the figures that have been revealed here by this Freedom of Information request as the number of prosecutions that simply aren't taking place?
Well, I actually missed this report when it came out, so I'm glad you brought it up, because it is quite shocking when you think people can condemn the police force for perceived inactivity, that they don't see criminals being put behind bars and everything. Well, actually, in these 4,000 suspects up to, that's what we refer to here, that's nothing to do with the police. The police have done their bit. They've caught what they perceive to be the criminal. It's the CPS that seem to have let the police down, and ultimately the communities down as well.
And so it means that there's potentially thousands of people who should be prosecuted and jailed just walking the streets because there was no prosecution ever came against them.
Ah, now jailed, that's an interesting one, because let's be fair, where would we put them?
OK, Martin, what are your thoughts on this one? Are you reading?
Well, obviously, I mean, we have Freedom of Information Act so that we can find out these things that we need to know. I mean, that's what I'd say. Obviously, that's why we need transparency, so that if there are failings, we can find out what they are and make sure that something's done about them. And I don't think this is a party political issue. I see that the Shadow Attorney General Edward Garnier told the paper these figures show the justice system under Labour. It's a fair comment from his point of view, because it has been a Labour government in power while this has been going on, but it shouldn't be party political. This should be sorted out, and somebody should sort it.
To be fair, it does say here, and it's the Sunday Express that did the Freedom of Information request, even though this story was in the Mail, it does say, to be fair, that it's only a fifth of 1% of the total number of criminal cases, the ones that weren't actually able to be dealt with. And I wonder, you know, is there anything we can do about this, Sue, to get the Crown Prosecution Service a little bit more efficient?
But I think they would need to go in and effectively look at how they're doing what they're doing now. You need to start with, what are you doing? How are you doing it? How can we improve it? To be fair, as you rightly said, it does say here that it was over 1 million prosecutions brought by the CPS in 2008-2009. That's a million cases. That's a significant figure. So you've got to ask yourself, do they have the manpower to actually follow through with what they're tasked to do? Are they funded properly? Do they have proper, structures in place? Do they have a protocol they need to follow? And again, it's about, I think it comes back to this open, honest transparency. People might have to hear some very hard truths about, you know, providing funding for organisations like this, because if it's because they're underfunded, then who's that benefiting? It's not benefiting the community. It's not benefiting the police. It's not benefiting, in Venice, it's not even benefiting the people who, and it does happen, may be arrested for a crime that they've not committed, who actually use the going to trial to prove their innocence. Well, what if one of those cases was one of these 4,000? That shadow hangs over people forever. So, you know, you've got to take it right back down to base level and build on that.
The other thing, of course, to mention is that the CPS are coming for quite a lot of criticism on other cases, such as, for example, the Charles de Menezes case in London, where the CPS made a final decision that there wasn't going to be a criminal investigation into the police officer who was in charge of that operation, and that it was going to be a health and safety inquiry. We also had the Cash for Questions business, where various MPs were interviewed by the police. A case was prepared, and then the Crown Prosecution Service again said, oh, we're not going to investigate this. And then, of course, this Equatorial Guinea thing that's been going on with the coup in Equatorial Guinea. We've also seen that there's clear evidence that there was criminal activity going on in Britain to overthrow Equatorial Guinea, which is, of course, a criminal offence, and yet the police and Crown Prosecution Service in that case as well, just deciding not to have a look at it. Martin, what are your thoughts about this, the CPS? Can it be reformed? Should it be reformed?
Listen, I don't know enough about it to have... clearly something needs to be done to fix whatever the failings are. The system of having the CPS doing the prosecutions rather than the police, in principle that might be a good idea, because it creates a separation of powers and so on.
But if the police have done a big investigation into something that they think is very important, the CPS then lose the paperwork. Doesn't that really dispirit the police?
Of course, but I mean, coming back to Sue's point about resources, if it is a resources issue, then it needs to be dealt with. And we've been talking in previous weeks about the Baby P case and the problems that social services having in dealing with child abuse, and everybody goes, when big cases like that come along, everybody gets on their high horse, it's all terrible, it's all shocking, blah blah blah. But if you want to do something about child abuse, you've got to spend the money to have the resources to have social workers, qualified social workers, on the ground knocking on doors, making sure that things are being kept in control. I mean, there are 250 children every year die as a result of the abuse by their carers in Britain. Of the 250, only 60 are known to social services. So if we're serious about doing something about things like that, that means money. Maybe the CPS, it means money as well. And from an economics point of view, this is the moment where we should actually be looking about what things we need to spend money on and spending money on them.
But isn't everybody saying, oh, we can't do our job properly, just give us more money? And shouldn't maybe they just be the heads of those quangos be sacked instead?
Well, it may be the case that it isn't a resource issue, it's a management issue. Yes, so let's not jump to conclusions here. But certainly in lots of other cases, for example, in relation to social services and child abuse, that is a resource issue.
We need more money for those people.
Okay, now, a lorry load of donated medical supplies, clothes and food has left Bristol for the besieged Palestinian province of Gaza today. The aim is to drive a lorry to its destination in the Middle East before Christmas. Anyway, Martin Summers was at the send-off this morning in Bristol city centre. Let's have a listen to one of the speakers from the Postman, the Communication Workers Union, that is, and then we will hear why Bristol City Council felt she had to be there in person this morning to add her voice to those wishing the relief lorry and the crew well.
Because we can't win our struggles, petty as they are, in terms of privatisation and wages and conditions as postal workers, unless this world wakes up to the fact that genocide is going on, that mass murder is going on, that Bangladeshi garment workers are working for Primark for threepence an hour, and unless those struggles are sorted out, and in particular the military problems of the world are sorted out, then we and our petty problems in terms of so-called highly developed Britain, we don't stand a diddly squat chance of winning anything.
I'm here with Barbara Yank, leader of Bristol City Council at the Gaza send-off. Why are you here, Barbara?
Well, I visited Gaza 20 years ago and I visited the refugee camps, and I was very moved by the plight of the people in this area. And since the Israeli invasion, their conditions have worsened immeasurably. And I'm really proud to see that a convoy of people from Bristol is going there to bring humanitarian aid, but also to raise awareness of the plight of the people of Gaza and to try and build up the effort to try and resolve this very long-standing and desperate situation.
All major political forces in the city are represented at this demonstration, are they not?
They certainly are. I think there's a very strong will across the parties to see a resolution of the desperate situation. Gaza is like a densely populated island. There is inadequate water. There is inadequate medical supplies. People there have known nothing but war for a very, very long time. And I think it's for all of us, the people here, not only to send their support and whatever aid they can to Gaza, but also to get behind an effort to try and bring resolution to the situation.
And what's the future for the Bristol-Gaza link, the idea of linking the Gaza with Bristol City?
The City Council has supported this, and I'm sure that councillors will want us to continue to do this, but it's a different kind of link. It's a link that's actually about action, it's actually about sending support, and it's actually about raising awareness with everybody in the city that their support is needed.
Okay, that's Martin Summers, who's live with us in the studio here as well. Martin, could you just take us through what you saw earlier on today? I mean, that was you chatting to Barbara.
Yeah, I mean, there was a send-off in the city centre. There's a big truck. We were talking about heavy lorries earlier. It's quite a big heavy lorry. It's full of medical supplies that have been raised by people in Bristol across the community, £20,000 worth of medical supplies. What was impressive was the political spread of the support for this initiative. I was very pleased to hear that Richard Eddy, the Conservative leader on the council, wasn't there, but he sent a message of support. Roger Berry was there representing the Labour Party. Stephen Williams and Barbara Yank were there representing the Liberals. And I think that sends a very strong message to Tel Aviv, to the Israelis, because we've got all sections of the community here have worked together to gather all this stuff together, and we're sending a clear we're sending humanitarian help, but we're also sending a clear message about where Bristol stands on this important issue.
I have to agree. I mean, take the countries and the politics out of it. You have, I believe, if I'm right, over a million people crushed into a very, very small space with no access to food or a safe access to medicine or water. You know, it doesn't matter who or where we're talking about. We should be doing absolutely everything we can to resolve that issue and get those people out. That's all they've known. They've not had the luxuries and the benefits that we've had as a country. Even though we're supposedly at war, we're not actually suffering as a result of that war on a day-to-day basis. And not having access to adequate medical facilities and clean water, it must be a nightmare, and I think it's about time that we actually did send a message to out quite clearly saying we cannot allow this to continue. Something, so action has to be taken to address this and address this now.
Can I just say that when we had a meeting in the City Academy here some months ago now, Tony Benn spoke at the meeting, but also Farouk Sadiq, Muslim Cultural Society, made a very pertinent point. He said he didn't agree with Muslims comparing what was going on to the Palestinians to the Holocaust. He said nothing compares to the Holocaust, and we're not suggesting for one minute that the Israeli state is carrying out a Holocaust against the Palestinian people. But he said, I think it's an absolutely fair and reasonable comparison to say what's going on in Gaza is very much like the Warsaw Ghetto before the ghetto was crushed. And I think that Israeli people need to look at their consciences and see what they're doing and recognise that the world does not support them in this belligerent stance that they're taking.
It's a very strange situation because we're bordered on one side by Egypt, which you would think would be a friendly Arab state and would be allowing all these supplies through.
No, the Egyptians are very much dependent upon US and Israeli support. They don't have a democracy in Egypt. It's a dictatorship, as many Arab countries are. But they're dictatorships supported by the West. So when we go on about they're not having a proper democratic election in Iran, well, they don't have proper democratic elections in Egypt either, but we don't say anything because the people in power are our chums.
Okay, on to another story now, and we've got Iran, which says it's building, this is end of last weekend, Iran says it's building 10 new enrichment sites for nuclear power stations. Enrichment sites is just a sort of spin, I imagine. I think this is quite interesting that they're announcing that they've got this nuclear power program coming out just about the same time as we're announcing our nuclear power program. I mean, it's just a week afterwards, really. So what are your thoughts on this, Sue? Are you really concerned about the Iranians developing nuclear power? Or do you think they're really developing nuclear weapons?
I'm not sure. I've got to be honest. It concerns me to see that there are references to enrichment sites and that they're not bluffs. But I would hope that the International Atomic Energy Agency would actually do everything they can to ensure that what we're being told is happening is actually what is happening, rather than it just being some smokescreen for weapons being developed. I've got to admit, I'm not overly happy about our nuclear power plans either. I'm not a great believer in nuclear power, basically because of the accidents that have happened and the health and safety records concerned and the threat to the population. So I would be much happier to see all of the renewable energy sources investigated fully before we actually opted down a nuclear power route. But hey,
well, to be fair to the Iranians, we're now on our third wave of nuclear power stations, and this is what they're talking about now, is an extra one at Hinkley and Albury and various other places around the country. So this is the third sort of load of nuclear power stations we've been building, and they're building their first. Martin, what do you think about this? Should we be biting our nails here at the Iranians
I'm not a supporter of nuclear power either, simply for economic reasons. Nuclear power has to be subsidised by the state. There's no way that a private sector would pick up the insurance bill for nuclear power. So when we're saying this decision to go for nuclear power is the government deciding to spend oodles and oodles of money, I would argue that there's a lot better ways to solve our problems than spending money on nuclear power. For example, like energy efficiency, as we were discussing earlier. The Iranian situation is extreme. We're being presented with an incredibly partial view of what's going on here. The Iranians are absolutely within their rights to want to build nuclear power stations if they want. They're signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike the Israelis, who are not signatories and have got loads of nuclear weapons. They're reckoned to have 200-plus usable warheads. And if I was the Iranian general staff, I'd be saying to the politicians, whoever they were, look, the Israelis have got 200 nuclear warheads, we need a bomb. Now, that's not what the Iranians are saying, and there's been no shred of evidence. There's lots of spin being put on this, that they're building a bomb. The kind of enrichment they're doing is nothing like as intense as required to build a bomb. Of course, ultimately, if you do have nuclear power, you can plan to build a bomb. That's how India got the bomb. They got a Canadian nuclear reactor, and they turned it into a fast breeder reactor, and they built a bomb. But frankly, the Pakistanis have got a bomb. The Israelis have got a bomb. The Americans have got loads of nuclear weapons pointing directly at the Iranians. If they had a bomb, would that be the end of the world? The answer is no. But it would mean that the Israelis wouldn't have a monopoly on nuclear force in the Middle East, and they'd have to talk in a bit more reasonable voice. Yeah? For example, about things like Gaza. So what's going on here is an Israeli-American strategy to demonise the Iranians because they are the opposition to what the Israelis and the Americans, and us, of course, don't forget us, we're tagging along, me too, as usual. And this is extremely dangerous. I mean, but they should just, they're within their rights with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty to build a nuclear power station if they want. And that's their, I mean, they could always just say, we're withdrawing from the treaty then. Mm-hmm. That's what they're talking about doing, because the Israelis aren't in it, we'll just withdraw. Now, once they've withdrawn from the treaty, they're under no obligation to do anything. They can build a bomb if they like then, because they're not in the treaty. But I don't think this kind of talk is the way we need to go for. We need to have a comprehensive Middle East peace settlement. Not escalations, not more wars. The wars have got us nowhere. More wars will get us further nowhere.
But surely the Iranians are escalating in this time, aren't they?
Well, the Iranians are basically saying, we might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. It doesn't matter what we do, however we bend over backwards, you're not interested. I mean, the Americans are quite clear in the Israelis that they want a regime change in Iran. So that they're not really interested in nuclear weapons or nuclear power anyway. This is the West's hostility to Iran is not about nuclear anything, really. It's about their oil and the fact that they're politically unbiddable. And they want, basically, they're one of the last places in the world which is not under the control of Western powers. And they're like a nut in a cracker, and they're trying to crack them.
OK, let's give Sue the final word on this.
Well, to be fair, I think some valuable points came out of that, and God, you're scarily intelligent, I must say. You know so much about things.
He's good on the. He's definitely good on the Middle East, Martin.
He's incredible and really well informed. But at the moment, as you rightly say, this is a story about 10 new enrichment sites with a lot of scary stuff. It could be they might be looking at building a bomb. All we actually know, there's no evidence, as you say, to support the fact that they are building a bomb. It's just people are right to be cautious about
okay.
it.
I have to stop you there, Sue. Thanks very much for joining us this week. It's nearly time for the Sky News at 6, so thanks very much, Sue. And stay with us, because the credit crunch beater Billy Quain will be here after the news with his guide to what's on for free and reasonably cheap around town this weekend.
It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.